Scribbler's Corner is brought to you by Brad Kuhn and Associates and the Jacks by Jacks Literary Arts Festival.
Hey, y'all. Welcome to Scribbler's Corner, the podcast about writers and writing, broadcasting from River of Grass Studios, where two rivers meet and you never know who will tie up to the dock for a chat and a fresh cup of coffee. I'm Darlin Finch Kuhn, but my friends call me the Scribbler. Today on Scribbler's Corner at River of Grass, we're talking with Tricia Booker. She's an award-winning journalist and neurotic writer of creative fiction who's unexpectedly very good at boxing. She lives in Ponte Vedra, Florida with her husband, two daughters, one son, and a variety of dogs. She's written for many publications, including Folio Weekly, Notre Dame, and Southern Living magazines, Minnesota's Law and Politics, and the Vero Beach Press Journal. She's taught creative writing to middle schoolers and inmates, and journalism to college students. She's currently a fitness instructor, a college journalism professor, and a dedicated domestic engineer. Booker's memoir, The Place of Peace and Crickets, recounts the journey she and her husband took through in vitro fertilization and ultimately international adoption to form from the chaos a family built on determination, heartache, and love. Tricia, welcome to River of Grass.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So we want to make sure that all the young writers out there who are aspiring to do what you've done and write a beautiful memoir or a novel or something like that, get the benefit of your experience. So what do you know now that you wish someone had told you when you were starting out as a writer?
I wish that I had known that the definition of success is not what society makes it out to be. I used to think when I was a young writer that the only way you can describe yourself as a successful writer is if you've published lots of books and you've made lots of money. And I know now that a successful writer writes and that you can't expect everything that you write to get published. And indeed, that's not even all of that important when it comes to being a writer who has had success. I think that I thought for a long time that publishing a book would change me and change my idea of how successful a writer I've been, but it didn't. I mean, I love having my book out there and it's meant the world to me, but I see now that what makes me a successful writer is that I write. I wish I had known that.
Very good. Yeah. So your book was actually sought out by a publisher in a sort of a reverse of the usual situation. Usually a writer will write a book and then search for a publisher, but your publisher read your blog and then asked you to write a book. So tell us about that.
Yeah, I kind of went about it backwards, but I would say that when I talk about writing, I always say that the first rule of writing creative nonfiction is just to start writing. And essentially, taking my own advice, that's how my book became published. I was a very harried, frenzied mother of three young children when I started my blog. I had barely time to shower, much less do anything creative. I wasn't doing any adulting. I was mostly mixing up mac and cheese that was a color not found in nature. And my children were 2, 4, and 7. And I felt like I was completely lost in diapers and food and poop. And I just decided to call a friend and complain about it. And my friend said, "You just need to start writing. Just start writing." And I said, "Well, I don't know what you mean." And she said, "Start a blog." And I didn't even know what a blog was. So she described it for me. And she said, "It's so easy. You set up a WordPress account and you just start writing." So I did it the next day, and I think I wrote this kind of inane story about taking my three kids to Starbucks and what a catastrophe it turned out to be. It wasn't any kind of brilliant piece of writing, but when I put it out there, I found that it really resonated with people. And more importantly, it allowed me to process what had happened. So when I had these kind of disastrous days, what I thought of as disastrous days, I would write about them. And I discovered that they weren't really disasters. They were just days of being a parent. And it allowed me to process what I was going through. So I did this for 9 years. I wrote this blog. And I had gone to a couple of writers' conferences, and I had befriended a woman named Pat Spears, who was also a writer. And she had just had her book published by Joan Leggett of Twisted Road Publications. And Joan, through Pat, had learned of my blog and read it. And they came to town one day, and she called me, and she asked me if I'd ever thought of putting my blog together in a book. And of course, I had thought of that, but I didn't really know whether I would, because I didn't know how I would get the book published. I just didn't know if it would be worth it. Anyway, she convinced me to try. And she said that if you put it together into a book, I want to be the first one to read it. And so that's what I did. And she read it and she loved it. And we worked together to edit it. And 6 months later, we had a manuscript.
Fantastic. So now you've got small children at home. And how in the world did you get this book written in that kind of chaotic time in your life? How did you actually physically get the work done?
By the time I started writing the book, my children were a little bit older and they were all in school. But I'm not one of those people who can have a full-time job and be a full-time mom and write at midnight. You know, you hear of all these people who kind of put their kids to bed and then they sit at the computer and write till 1 or 2 in the morning. I'm not that kind of person. I need my 8 hours of sleep. So what I did was give up everything else. I would write every day while my kids were at school. I would write for hours, and I did this 3 or 4 days a week. I had to stop everything to do it, to put it together. It was a full-time job. And I don't know how people write books part-time. It's beyond me, because for me, it took everything out of me.
I see. Well, it seems like it was well worth the effort. It's been acclaimed by some wonderful writers themselves who blurbed the book.
I know that
author Laura Vandenberg says about The Place of Peace and Crickets that it's a blisteringly honest, very funny, and totally unforgettable memoir. And author Katrina Ann Willis calls your book, calls you a brilliantly talented new voice with a story that is as much ours as it is hers, a story of searching, of finding, and of accepting. And I've read your book. I thought it was wonderful. And I actually read it on the plane to Bermuda and kept poking my husband in the ribs with my elbow while he was trying to watch an in-flight movie to read portions of the book to him. And then that's not all that unusual. We do that to one another all the time. But the unusual part is that after we landed in Bermuda and I went to sleep with jet lag, he started reading the book in bed and then proceeded to poke me with his elbow and read portions of the book to me that I had just finished reading on the plane. So it was that good.
I kept you both awake at opposite times.
Well, we're not sorry, because we really, really enjoyed the book, and it was that good that we couldn't not read excerpts to one another.
Thank you.
So how do you juggle writing and a day job now? You teach at the University of North Florida. You teach journalism there. And how do you keep up with writing and teaching?
I have a very supportive husband, and he helps me plot out writing times. So on days when I don't have to go into the university, or on weekends, and to be honest, it's usually on weekends, he will say, okay, which day do you want to be your writing day, Saturday or Sunday? And we'll block it off. And sometimes I'll go into the university office just to have quiet. It's funny, I can't write in small snippets of time. For a long time, my husband would say, okay, you just got to write when you can. Grab 20 minutes here, 20 minutes there. I can't do that. It takes me half an hour to kind of get into the mindset to start writing. So I need 3 or 4 hour chunks of time. So fortunately, he's been able to help me carve that time out. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to do it.
That sounds wonderful. Sounds like you've got a partner who really understands the needs of the writer. Are you a writer who edits as you go, or do you just write the whole first draft, or do you, what's that process like? Or
I do a little bit of both. I have a background in journalism, and so when you're a journalist, you have to write quickly and you've got to write cleanly. So as I'm writing, I can tell whether something is kind of good. If it's pretty good, I just keep going. If it's terrible, I will go back and erase it. So I'm a huge fan of editing, even my blog. I write my blog and I edit it once and I edit it twice. And then I send it to my husband to edit because he gets first, he can always tell me if something is too personal to write, if it involves him. And then I edit it again myself. So I guess the answer is both. I kind of edit as I go, but then when I'm done, I always go back and give it another really good edit. Editing is probably the most important part of writing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think your first draft, Anne Lamott, who wrote Bird by Bird, always said that she was a fan of shitty first drafts. And first drafts are always pretty shitty because you leave in all of your comma errors and your spelling errors and your double negatives. And then when you reread it, you're able to fine tune the context. So I follow that rule.
I see. So what's the hardest part of writing for you?
Easily prioritizing it and finding the time. I think writing is like a muscle. It's no different than a skill like playing basketball. I mean, if you never play basketball and then you go out to make a three-point shot, you're probably not going to make it. But if you go and practice that shot every day, maybe some days you'll make it and some days you won't. But by the time it really counts, you'll be able to do it. Writing is the same way. You can't start writing once every 6 months and expect to have good stuff come out. You've got to write all the time. If it's not every day, you've got to write three times a week, at least twice a week. And if you're not writing that often, you're not exercising that writing muscle. So finding the time and prioritizing is harder to do. But at the same time, writing can be painful. I mean, sometimes you're writing stuff and it makes you cry and it's tapping into emotions you don't want to feel. So taking the time to do something that can make you vaguely uncomfortable, again, it's like exercise, making yourself go do something that you know is good for you and is you know is going to have good results, but is going to make you vaguely uncomfortable. Well, sometimes we would rather eat donuts, right? But we make ourselves do it. So that's easily the hardest part.
I remember that Connie Mae Fowler at Rollins College used to tell us, no tears in the writer, no tears in the reader. And she would describe just sitting at her computer and writing a page and then weeping over it. And that's when she knew she had something good.
Oh my gosh, that's so familiar to me. When I was doing the bulk of the writing of my memoir, it was right after my father had died. And a lot of my memoir, although it primarily is about bringing our family together, a lot of it takes place in New Orleans when I was a child. And so I would be writing about passages about my father, and it would, oh boy, those would be really emotionally exhausting days. And my husband would come home, or my kids would come home, and my eyes would be red from crying, and I would just feel drained.
Yeah. So now let's talk about that. You write a lot about your family of origin and your current nuclear family, how your family came together and your journey through in vitro fertilization and artificial insemination and then eventually adoption, international adoption, with all of the difficulties that ensue from that. So how do you write about family and still have a family to write about?
That's a good question. And I think that's a problem a lot of writers who want to write memoir encounter. First of all, I tell people that there is no crime against writing about your family. If you decide later not to publish what you write about your family, that's a completely different decision. But first, you've got to write it out. And what I have found when you're writing about family is that once you write it out, you often find that the story really isn't about your family at all. It's really about you and you can work around your family's involvement in the story. And that's what I found, particularly when I was writing about my original family, my parents and my sisters and growing up. They were very leery to have me write some of the things that I was writing about. They didn't even like me really writing about stuff about my family, but that of course was my family's decision. But what I found is that when I was writing stories about me growing up, the stories really didn't involve them. I mean, they were there and they may have had the same experience, but if I wasn't really talking about them, they didn't really have to be in the story. So that is kind of how I got around that. And sometimes if I needed somebody in the story, I would change a name or I'd change a location. And I didn't feel like that was being untrue to the story because the story did not lose its meaning. The same context was there. So that helped.
Yeah. So speaking of memoir, what are some of the common mistakes that you see in memoirs that have been published that sort of keep them from capturing the attention of the reading public? And how did you avoid those mistakes?
I think one problem a lot of memoir writers have is that they write themselves as either a victim or as a hero, or they talk too much about how they feel instead of just telling a story. What we went through was very difficult, and I think I could have easily portrayed myself as a victim, but I didn't do that. I avoided it by telling the reader exactly what had happened. I didn't talk about how I felt. I talked about our behavior. I talked about what happened. And in that way, it really resonated with people. I didn't talk about how I felt sorry for myself. I didn't talk about being sad. I talked about what happened and then let the reader kind of intuit the feelings part. Mm-hmm. I think that was really, really important for me to be brutally honest. And I was brutally honest, not just about the problems that my children had, but about my bad behavior as well. I was not the perfect mom. I'm still not the perfect mom. But when we were trying to figure out what was my son's diagnosis, he was eventually diagnosed with reactive attachment disorder. But when we were trying to figure that out, I had some really not stellar days. I had some definite parenting fails. And I wasn't shy about telling them. I don't want other parents out there who are experiencing hard times to think they're the only ones dealing with that. We all have our really bad moments as parents.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you were very honest about it. And those were some of the most touching moments, was that sense of vulnerability and opening up and saying, you know, this is the raw truth about me and my family and what we went through. And balancing out that, those moments that were almost very hard to read, there were these moments of transcendent beauty in the book that showed the deep, deep love that overcame those troubles. So I think those are the kinds of things that people relate to. And it gives us hope that when we're going through these dark times, that the moments of transcendent beauty are out there beyond. So do you want to talk about some of the moments in the book where you went from hard times to?
Yeah. There was one incident in particular when my son, I had bought my kids smoothies and we had come home. I had gotten them McDonald's and smoothies. I mean, right there is a not stellar moment for a mom when you're buying your kids McDonald's and smoothies for dinner. But when we got home, my son Nico had dropped his smoothie and he was mad. He wanted me to go get him another one, and I wouldn't. I couldn't. I mean, the smoothie place was like half an hour away. And so I told him I would make him another smoothie. No, that wasn't good enough. And he dissolved into just a mess. He was just an angry, irrepressible, violent mess. And I couldn't control him, so I just kind of walked around behind him. And he decided that he was going to drive my car. So he got my keys and he got in my car and started it. And that scared me.
And how old was he at this time?
10.
Okay. Not old enough to drive your car.
No, not old enough to drive my car, but old enough to know how to start it. So I went and got the keys out of the car and I pulled him out of the car and I locked the car and then I hid the keys and he was furious. So he said to me, "You want to keep the car locked? I'll lock it." And he went and got a roll of duct tape and he duct taped the whole car shut. I mean, he went out there and he started at one end of the car and he climbed up on the roof and he duct taped it like it was a box, like he was packing up a box. And he used the whole roll of duct tape. And I texted his art therapist while he was doing this and said, "Nico is duct taping my car." And she wrote back, "Don't let him do that. He cannot do that." And I sat there with a beer in the living room watching him. And I texted back, "Okay, I won't." But the funny thing is that right after that, he came in and he was so mad. And he looked at the vacuum and he said, "I'm going to break the vacuum now." And I said, "Okay." And he started trying to break the vacuum. But in trying to break it, he started trying to figure out how it worked. And he took it apart and put it back together and started vacuuming. And he kind of healed himself. He found a way to heal himself and find himself again. He found his zen and he became himself again. He turned himself around. And it really was an astounding thing to watch. He knew what he needed more than I did. And he needed to focus on something. And by the time he was able to focus on something, he had the will to calm down and turn his behavior around. And it was just amazing to watch.
Yeah. It's amazing for me as a mother to hear about the patience that must have taken to sit and watch him work it out for himself. I'm a sort of a controlling fixer, and that's not always the best thing to do. Allowing the child to work it out is, that's pretty amazing. And it was successful for you and your son.
It was, although I'll say that I had lots of times when I wasn't patient and I wasn't actually waiting for him to work it out himself at that particular moment. I was waiting for his episode to end. But it was an important lesson to me that I was, that I watched, that I let this happen. I let this unfold and it taught me that I needed to be more patient.
I see. Wow. So one of the characters in your book is a service dog named Buddy. And this was one of the avenues that you tried in order to help Nico. You bought and trained Buddy to be a companion for your son. And how did you and your son handle it when Buddy bonded with you instead?
Do you want to
read us that portion of your book and kind of explain what happened?
I'll just give you a brief intro. I had decided that we kept looking for the silver bullet with the thing that was going to cure Nico. And I had decided one day after reading an article that we needed to get a service dog, that was the only thing that would solve our problems. So this is soon after the dog came home. We found a dog trainer to help us with Buddy, and our weekly sessions went really well for 2 weeks before Nico refused to participate in them. Life started reclaiming my time away from Buddy training, and soon I was more overwhelmed than ever. 3 kids, 2 dogs, a fish, and a husband. My whole life centered on poop, body odor, and food preparation, sometimes all at once. God, the poop. And more poop. Buddy the Wonder Dog, for a long stretch, could have more aptly been named Buddy the Pooping, Chewing, Anxious, Thirsty, Enormous Pain in the Ass Dog. He still had a lot of love to give, but he mostly was giving it to me. He stuck to me like a tick. If I stood up, he stood up. If I walked to the bathroom, he trotted alongside me. He loved Nico, but he adored me like I was a slab of bacon. Nico loved Buddy, but still preferred putting together Legos over doing a single thing related to Buddy's basic survival. After a few weeks, our new dog trainer noticed how anxious Buddy became whenever I was out of his sight. "This dog has really bonded to you," she said. "He thinks you're his person." "Gee, you think?" I answered. I walked him. I picked up his enormous pony-sized poops. I gave him treats. I fed him. I corrected him. Of course I was his person. My son adored his new dog and spent lots of time lounging around with him. But Nico was not prone to chores or prolonged discussions about anything other than Pokemon. It was looking like Buddy would be my service dog, which was not unattractive to me. I felt pretty needy. But the trainer was concerned. No, I mean, really, really bonded, she said, like he's totally anxious without you. We pondered her words for a moment while Buddy stared at me. Wait, I finally said. Are you telling me that this dog, which I bought to help my son with an attachment disorder, now has an attachment disorder? Well, she said, sort of. Yes, that is exactly what she meant. So I had two brown-haired, 80-pound mammals sucking the life out of me, and neither of them liked to bathe. At least I was right about one thing. This dog had changed my life.
Wow. Thank you so much. And that sort of illustrates the tone of the book. There's moments of humor like that. And at the same time, it's very touching. There were moments when I read the book where my mouth just hung open. And then there were moments when, I cried right along with the writer. So it was magical. Let's switch gears just for a moment and talk about your teaching career. You are an adjunct professor at the University of North Florida teaching journalism to young people. And my question for you is, what is that like right now when you and I were young, we all wanted to be Woodward and Bernstein and go out and save the world for democracy. But now the journalists of today are being called the enemy of the people. So I'm kind of interested in how you are encouraging people to go into the field.
I don't think young people today, the kids that I'm teaching, really know what journalism is. They think of journalism as what you see when you turn on the news. I don't think they read. Well, I know they don't read investigative stories. They don't read the daily paper. They don't know what's going on in their own communities. I don't quite understand how they know who to vote for. So when I'm teaching journalism, I'm teaching them to determine what's right and what's wrong. And I don't mean in the moral sense. I mean in the information sense. What's good information? What's bad information? Who are your sources? Where are your sources online? Where are you getting your statistics? Who are you interviewing? And then in a different sense, I am asking them to make a moral decision sometimes. Who's wearing the black hats and who's wearing the white hats? Because sometimes there are definite lines to be drawn. I'm not talking about people whose opinion you disagree with. But when you're interviewing people and you're doing a story and you know that one side is not giving you the truth, you know that one side is lying, it demonstrably lying. Well, you can't always be objective about that. Sometimes you have to point that out. And I think that in many cases is why journalism is sometimes being called the enemy of the people, because they are pointing out things that are not true, things that are wrong. And I think that's difficult for some people to read because they're not doing their own research and they're not finding the right sources of information. Mm-hmm. So that's what I teach them. I teach a class called Media Literacy, in which we literally look at stories and how they are sourced, and we trace back to the original information, the original sources of information. So I can teach them, well, this is what so-and-so said. This is what this senator said. Let's look to see if it's true. Well, it's not true. Now, as a journalist, do you report that it's not true? How do you handle that? So that has been fascinating to them. This is not something that occurred to them, that politicians would not tell the truth.
Wow. Well, I'm glad that you're opening their eyes before they get out into the world and work as journalists. Since you've been a journalist and a feature writer and now a memoirist, how do those types of writing compare and contrast? And what would you say to a young person who wanted to be a writer?
It depends on how young the person is, but I guess my primary advice would be to read. Read, 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 read. There are no good writers who are not also good readers. I had somebody challenge me on that the other day. He came up to me after a presentation and said, I'm going to amend that a little bit and say, there are some good writers who are not good readers. And I said, no, there are none. And he said, well, I have dyslexia. And I said, well, you know what? There are lots and lots of people in this world who have dyslexia and they also read. You read slower, you may read less, but you must read. And you must, if you have trouble reading and you don't like to read, well, then you make sure that you're always reading quality stuff. You cannot get the syntax of reading, of writing, unless you are reading good stuff. So read everything you can. And then you just need to start writing. I think the more you write, again, like I said earlier, it's like a muscle. The more you develop that writing muscle, the more you start to learn what you're good at. I think the difference between journalism and creative nonfiction and memoir writing, it's just the amount of detail and story that you put in. I think good writing is good writing. And I discovered that kind of backwards because I was a prolific creative writer before I went to school to get my master's in journalism. And I thought I wrote really, really good stuff. But in journalism, when I was working in graduate school, they really boiled down my writing to the basics, to like the perfect stock. And then I could start adding details and adding, especially with my creative nonfiction, I used a lot of fiction techniques to add layers of complexity to my creative nonfiction. I don't think I could have done that if I didn't have the basic writing skills fine-tuned through journalism.
So what are you working on next? What can we expect to hear from Tricia Booker in the near future?
I think I'm working on not enough right now. I have all kinds of ideas. The first thing I have to do is get my blog going again. This is the longest I haven't been writing on my blog. It's been about 3 months, and I want to start that again. I've been writing as a subcontractor for someone else right now, and I'm trying to finish that project before I get into anything for myself. But I dream of projects every day. I think when you are a true writer, then you write paragraphs in your head all the time. And that's what I do. Like when I'm driving down the road, I'll see a sign or I'll see a farm or I'll see a homeless person and I'll think, oh, that's a story. And it's all I can do not to pull over the car right there and start interviewing somebody or start writing. That's the kind of stuff I want to do. Maybe make them longer stories. I would love to do profiles of people in Jacksonville who are leading extraordinary lives. I think the most ordinary people in our worlds are leading extraordinary lives. I met a student the other day who was telling me about the life that she had led up until this point. She's 21 years old and she's completely on her own now. And her brother dropped out of high school to support their disabled mother, and he is still living there now at age 20, supporting their disabled mother. That's what he does. He wasn't able to finish high school or go to school because this is his job. And it occurred to me that there are so many people in our circle, in our aura, who are living like that, doing extraordinary things that just seem like ordinary people to us. Those are the heroes among us. And those are the stories I'd like to tell.
Oh, I hope you get started on that soon. And I hope you start with that one. That really does sound fascinating. I want to circle back around because you told me recently about an incident that happened when your book was about to come out. You had cleared with the family, the people that you felt it was important to make sure that they didn't worry too much about a memoir coming out where they were actually characters. But then just before your book was about to be published by Joan Leggett of Twisted Road Publications in Tallahassee, you were going on a television show and Nico said something important to you. So tell that story to our listeners that you told me recently.
Nico was 12 and the book was about a week away from coming out. So I was starting to do some publicity in advance and I was getting ready to go be interviewed for a television program. And as I was walking out the door, Nico called me over and said, "Mom, I changed my mind about the book. I don't want the book to come out." And I kind of froze for a second and I said, "Why not?" And he said, "I don't know, Mom. I just think it's personal and I just am scared." And I said, "Okay, well, I'm going to do this interview. And when I come back, we can talk about this. And if you don't want the book to come out, sweetie, the book won't come out." That at that point was a near impossibility, but I had to go. So I told him something just to placate him. And when I came back, he had watched later on that day, I guess there was some time that had lapsed, and he had watched the program on television by the time I came back. And he said, "Mommy, I changed my mind. I want the book to come out." And I said, "Well, honey, that's wonderful. What changed your mind?" And he said, "Well, I heard what you said about how this is really going to help people and how it could help other moms and dads understand their kids better. And I think that's really important. And I'm really proud of us, Mom. And so I want the book to come out." And I was really proud of him for thinking that way.
Yeah. Yeah. For someone who was laser focused on what he wanted and being a young boy like that, for him to open up his heart and his life, you know, to scrutiny, was a very brave and generous thing to do. So I'm sure you were proud. It makes me proud of him as well. So you mentioned writing about Jacksonville characters, and we're very lucky to have you living here in town, out at the beach at Ponte Vedra. And so what do you feel about the writing community in Jacksonville? How's that working for you? And, what resources are there out there, say, for instance, for some of the baby scribblers out there who want to be you when they grow up? What are the resources and how's this community as far as supporting writers?
Gosh, it has changed so much over the past 20 years. Which is how long I've been here. Actually, 25 years. I've been here 25 years.
Yeah.
It has changed dramatically. I think the arts and culture scene in Jacksonville has just exploded. And I think there are so many options if you are a writer and you need support. There are writer groups that meet. There are writing courses that you could take that are long-term, multi-weeks. There are classes at universities that you can take. There are lots of online writing communities as well. But in addition, our business community has gotten involved too. There are poetry slams at different bars and restaurants every week. There are writing gigs where it's kind of open mic and you can show up and read your stuff to an audience and see how it's received. We have our Jacks by Jacks writing festival every year, which you and Brad have begun organizing, which has been going on for 6 years. And I think that's become kind of a showcase event in Jacksonville. I think that if you want support and you want a community, it's there for you. And it's not at all exclusive. It's open. People want you to be involved.
Well, I agree with you. I think the scene is very vibrant and there's something to do every night of the week. And actually sometimes that's to the detriment of actually sitting down and writing something fresh and new. At least it is for me. I'm so busy running out, listening to all the wonderful writers that are out at events like that, that I sometimes forget to sit down and write something new. But
you're actually an amazing supporter of young writers. I think you're kind of an inspiration, and your support of young writers in this community, I think, has been stellar.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I did want to mention, since you mentioned Jacks by Jacks Literary Arts Festival, that one of the new things that we're doing is the writing workshops. We're having them on the first Monday of each month leading up to the event that's going to be on November 16th. And, you know, coming to the writing workshop isn't going to guarantee anyone that they will be selected for the festival, but it certainly can't hurt to have their poem or short piece of prose critiqued by their fellow writers. And we have people who have never walked into a writing workshop before, and then we have the veterans. So the opportunity is there for people who want to join the conversation to have a chance to do so. So they can look at jacksbyjacks.com and figure out when and where things are going on.
Yeah, I think that's great that you all have started that program. The more opportunities we can give writers to commune with other writers, the better.
I agree. Well, what else would you like the world to know about Tricia Booker?
Well, if you read my book, you'll know way more about me than you ever wanted to know. So I would encourage you to do that. But I guess one of the things that has been very important to me is writing about personal things. It's not everybody's gig, but for me, it has helped. And not just me, but in my circle, I think it has raised the ability to talk about these things. It has released people from the shame of having a mental disability, for example. My son is now growing up with the knowledge that he has a condition that in no way was caused by him and that he has nothing to be ashamed of. He'll tell people he has a service dog because sometimes he has terrible anxiety and he needs a best friend. People love that. I mean, his friends think that's awesome. We all have anxiety. And when he tells people that sometimes he has anxiety, his friends don't say, really, you have anxiety? They say, oh yeah, I have that too. And I think letting people be honest about how they feel and the things that they suffer from, I think it has been everything to me. I suffer from depression as well. And being able to talk about it and say, look, this is something I suffer from, and it makes me a not very pleasant person sometimes. I don't talk about it like I'm a victim. I talk about it like this is a condition I have, and this is what happens. And if you see me and I'm kind of a bitch, well, this is why. And I think being honest about it kind of releases the shame. I'm not ashamed. I mean, not treating my depression, there might be shame in that. But having depression and treating it and sometimes suffering from it, that's the way it is. And I like, and maybe it's partly maturity. I'm probably at least half my life is over now. I'm 55 years old. And I think when you get to a point in your life and you thought, you know what? I don't want to hide myself anymore. I don't want to hide who I am. And I don't want to really hide what I go through. So I love being able to write and express myself in that way, in a way that resonates with other people and may help other people to rise up and be themselves.
Absolutely. And I know there's a part of you that's very interested in eating right, exercising, getting plenty of sleep as a sort of bulwark against depression. And you also box, and you've even taught boxing. So talk about how those things contribute to being, a healthy person and how they contribute to your ability to write.
Yeah, I had a hysterectomy about 12 years ago, I guess. It was one of the best days of my life. I had severe endometriosis and it released me from a lot of pain. And after that, when I was trying to get back in shape, I had a trainer who was an MMA fighter. And as we were training, he started teaching me how to box and I loved it. And I was strangely very good at it. And yeah, I did teach boxing at our Ponte Vedra YMCA for a while. I haven't taught it lately because I have carpal tunnel syndrome and I'm trying to figure out what to do about that. But I do CrossFit and I work out quite a bit. It's always been my belief that physical strength is mental strength. And I take care of myself because there are going to be times when your mental abilities, your mental acuity is not where it should be because you're exhausted, because you're drained, because you're having a bout of depression. But if your physical strength is there, it can carry you through. I really believe that. I do get enough sleep. I'm not one of those people who says I'm proud of the fact that I work late and only get 6 hours of sleep. I can't function like that. I do eat right. If I have a bad eating day, I have like a sugar hangover the next day. I don't feel right. So it's really important for me to nourish my body as well as my mind. And I do CrossFit. I'm not a particularly great CrossFitter, but I do it and it keeps me in shape. And I love being able to feel strong. And it really does keep me strong in my head. It's a very important part of my life. I think there's components to keeping myself well-rounded and healthy. So it's eating right, sleeping well, taking care of my body, working out, writing, and gosh, what else is it? Oh, my antidepressants, they help too.
Oh, yes. Always. Okay, so I've been thinking about how to help the writers who are listening who want to open up their lives a little bit, maybe write some memoir pieces, but are running into roadblocks. What are some of the classic roadblocks, and how would you advise writers to overcome them?
I think the primary roadblock that writers face when writing about their personal lives is themselves. I think there's a fear of offending someone. Just because you write something doesn't mean you have to publish it. You got to write it down to figure that out. So the number one rule is that you just got to write it down. Now, have it on a computer that's password protected if you think somebody's going to come in your house and dig through your stuff. But sometimes you write something and it turns out really not to be what you think. It doesn't present the problems that you think. So the first thing is to just write it down. The second thing is to tackle your memory. Sometimes we want to write about things and we're worried that we don't have all the details. Well, there are ways that you can spark your memory. If there's a time in your life that you want to write about and you're having trouble remembering, you can go back to that place, the physical place. Sometimes that will remind you of something. You can look at photographs from that period of time. Sometimes you can look at newspapers from that period of time as well. And maybe there are incidents that happened, events that happened in the world that will spark your memory. You can ask family members about that period of time. See what their recollections are. See if they jibe with yours.
And what do you do, Tricia, if they don't? What if you write something and then someone says, that's not what happened?
I believe that in life, as well as in writing, you have to have the courage of your convictions. If you remember something and it is your memory, you have a right to it. If someone reads it and says, that didn't happen that way, I guess it depends on how clear your memory is of it. If your memory is clear, you have to trust yourself. I'm only advising asking other people if you're having trouble recalling a memory, but there are certainly things that I wrote in my book that members of my family disagreed with, but I trusted myself. I didn't include them in the story. It was my story. And in some cases, they were disappointed and in one case, outright mad at something that I wrote. But it was my story, and I have a right to tell my story. I think there are people who thought that by writing my children's story, I was negatively affecting them. But they're my kids, and it's my family, and it was our decision. It wasn't their decision. I've heard people say, oh, I want to tell that story, but I can't write that story until so-and-so's dead. Well, first of all, that's a terrible way to think about things. And second of all, of course you can write it. Of course you can write that story. You don't have to publish it, but you can write it, and you might find a way around the problem that you think you're having. Or you can write it and publish it after she's dead.
Absolutely. And I always feel like inviting people who would dispute something that I remember and want to write about, I always feel like inviting them to write their own story, their own version.
Exactly.
If you disagree with mine.
Yeah.
So it is.
Sometimes I think if you don't want me to write about you, then you should behave better.
Be nice to me. Exactly. Okay. Well, that's been, it's just been fascinating to talk with you, and I really, really appreciate it. And I hope that, you know, we'll see you again, maybe out at one of the Jacks by Jacks writing workshops. And
Absolutely. And I would love to be there. Thank you.
Thank you. And let us know the next time you have a reading and what all, and we'll put it on Scribbles and get some folks out to hear you, because it is one of the best books I've read in a long, long time. And I want to share it with the world.
Thank you.
So next up on Scribbler's Corner, we're going to be talking with Ebony Payne English, and she has a show coming up from 2 to 4 p.m. on April 7th at Mocha, and it's called The God MC, The Herstory of Hip-Hop Culture. So we are looking forward to finding out all about that and chatting with Ebony Payne English on the next Scribbler's Corner at River of Grass. Don't make me come get you. Scribbler's Corner is produced by Brad Kuhn and Associates, a multimedia production company making authors' dreams come true for almost a decade. BKNA offers a full print shop with design services for everything from books to bookmarks and banners, digital audio recording, video book trailers, and animation, priced for self-published authors and indie publishers. The Corner is also brought to you by the Jax by Jax Literary Arts Festival, Jacksonville Writers Writing Jacksonville, now in its sixth year. Writer applications open July 1st for this year's event, which will be held on Saturday, November 16th. And finally, a podcast wouldn't be a podcast without listeners like you. If you like what you're hearing and want me to keep doing it, please do me the favor of subscribing and spreading the word by telling at least one friend about us.